Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Today on the show, we'll take a look at what's next for two of the Massachusetts ballot questions voters decided on this week. Question two failed, so what will charter school advocates do now? Question four passed, but state lawmakers are already saying there are some obstacles to quickly legalizing marijuana sales. Also, what's it like being on a tiny island in the northern Atlantic, hunkered down in a winter storm and all alone?
So there was one year where there was a 91 mile an hour storm. And I was there alone, and I stayed inside because with the big old buildings, often the roofing tiles will fly off, and parts of the building will blow away. But even inside, it's scary because the whole house vibrates, and the window glass just bows inward, and you can see it. It almost looks like it's breathing.
That's next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we have been spending quite a lot of time talking about the enormous national impact of this week's presidential election. But on Tuesday, Massachusetts voters also took a stand on ballot questions of major significance to this state. So for a big chunk of the show today, we're going to take a closer look at what's next for two of those issues, charter schools and legal recreational marijuana. First, let's look at marijuana, because voters approved ballot question four 54-46%, which means that Massachusetts residents older than 21 can legally use recreational marijuana beginning December 15th of this year, and retail stores are scheduled to open at the beginning of 2018. But some state officials are already saying that timeline may not be reasonable. So joining us now to talk about it is Will Luzier. He's campaign manager for Yes on 4, and they, of course, supported the legalization of recreational marijuana. Mr. Luzier, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us is State Senator Jason Lewis. He represents the 5th Middlesex, and he was on the campaign for a safe and healthy Massachusetts. They were opposed to question four. Senator Lewis, good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Amanda. Thank you.
Also good to have you because a lot of these questions have to do with how Beacon Hill is going to act. So listeners, I just want to throw the number out for you. If you've got questions for Will Luzier or Senator Jason Lewis, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What do you want to know about how Massachusetts is going to move forward with the now legal use of marijuana in this state? So let's start off with what Treasurer Deborah Goldberg just recently said yesterday, because she's going to be the state's top regulator of marijuana, and she's going to have to name the three folks who will be on the Cannabis Commission. She called on the legislature to extend the deadline for opening retail stores because she said she needed extra time to build her oversight force to do that. So here's Treasurer Goldberg on the timeline that was outlined in the ballot question.
If you think about it in the context of how long, even if you own a private business, how long it takes to get up and running, some of those deadlines are pretty tough.
So Will Luzier, let's start with you. I mean, what do you make of the fact that Treasurer Goldberg says she doesn't know if the state can be ready for marijuana sales by 2018?
Well, let's look at Colorado. Colorado voted on this in November of 2012, and the retail sales started in January of 2014. So it's exactly the same timeline. But Colorado didn't have a blueprint like we do. We now have four states that have legalized, plus the District of Columbia. So we can look at the regulations from all of those states, get best practices, and have the best regulatory framework in the country. And we don't, we already have a blueprint. We're not going to reinvent the wheel.
Okay. So, Senator Lewis, what's your thought on that? And of course, I mean, voters have passed the question, so we're not wondering whether or not it's good for Massachusetts. The question is the timeline realistic?
So, Megna, let me start by congratulating Will and the proponents of the ballot question for a very strong campaign that they ran and for their victory on Election Day. I want to say right at the outset that I and I believe all the members of the legislature and the governor will fully respect the will of the voters, and we will move as quickly and as expeditiously as possible to implement this new law. There are many critical details that have to be worked out in the days and months ahead, and you know, so I do think as we really dig in and get moving on implementation, one of the questions we will have to consider is, can we get it all done, you know, in the timeline that's laid out? The timeline really is the middle of September of next year, because that's the time in the ballot question by when all the regulations are supposed to have been drafted and promulgated. So that really is 9 or 10 months, and to get there, we would have to stand up a whole regulatory structure, hire the staff, put technology in place, get input from all the different stakeholders. It's a lengthy and challenging process.
I take your point, because Treasurer Goldberg also said that she won't even have the information until January, February about how long it might take to create this IT backbone that the state would need to track from seed to sale. Might not even be possible to have a system ready by next October. You know, these are concerns that the Treasurer is putting forth. But Senator Lewis, let me ask you, respond to what Will Luzier said, that, you know, Massachusetts has a blueprint on how to pull this off, because it was done in Colorado.
We would certainly be wise to look to Colorado's experience, as well as Washington State and a few others. And in fact, both Treasurer Goldberg and her team went out to, I believe, Washington, and I led a Senate delegation out to Colorado. So we've been doing our homework to get ready. That said, one of the main pieces of advice that I received from Governor Hickenlooper's team in Colorado when I was there was, you really need to implement this very thoughtfully and very carefully, and make sure you have enough time to do it right.
Will Luzier, your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we're not reinventing the wheel. This is a timeline that was voted on by the voters, and I think I appreciate the senator's suggestion that everyone wants to comply with the will of the voters, but you know, we need to make sure that folks are not they have this opportunity to purchase marijuana within the timeline, the time frame that's outlined in the initiative.
So I want to play another piece of tape here. This is from Governor Charlie Baker. He spoke yesterday, and he was asked about how quickly Massachusetts could ramp up to get sales online by the time stated in the ballot question. And he said he wants, no matter what happens, he wants it to be an efficient and effective process.
I don't want to go through, for example, the disconnects and the false starts that were associated with the state's implementation of the medical marijuana law.
So the governor there referring to the fact that it took medical marijuana quite some time to get the system fully worked out across the state, and it was with a lot of hurdles and obstacles there. Jason Lewis, let's start with you. Respond to that, because the governor's right to point out that it was supposed to be one thing on paper when medical marijuana was passed, but the implementation was quite different. I mean, could that happen here again?
Well, I completely agree with the governor. We should learn lessons from the implementation of medical marijuana, which I think everyone agrees took far too long and was had too many problems. And I think we must do better this time. And we will. I'm confident we will. But that doesn't change the fact that there are so many details that have to be worked out. Let me just give you one example, Megna. There's no funding specified in this ballot question to start to stand up a regulatory structure, because the license fees and the taxes that would come, you know, would fund that won't come in until sometime in the future.
So let me just jump in there.
So that's a solution the legislature will have to address immediately, is how are we going to actually get going and get put the funding in place? That's just one example.
Yeah, so I just wanted to get Will Luzier's thoughts on that particular concern.
We talked to Senator Lewis's office in August of last year about the possibility of some kind of a loan program, similar to what happened with the Gambling Commission, where they were funded and then paid the money back once the fees started to come in. We also approached several senators about putting pre-funding this and putting it in this year's budget. But they said, no, let's wait. There's opportunities for supplemental budgets all the time, and we can fund it in a supplemental budget. So, I don't think that the funding issue is a hurdle that can't be overcome.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, because I think everyone knows we have an extremely tight state budget, we would have to figure out where this funding will come from, and if it's going to be a loan, how we structure that, and there are issues with our credit rating. The point is, it can be solved, but we have to sort that out. Another example.
How much of a priority is this going to be in the new legislative session?
This will be right at the top of the list of priorities, I suspect, going into the new legislative session, and I know from the Senate president, the governor, and the Speaker of the House, I think all agree that this is a top priority issue in the new session, which starts in January.
Well, let's take a couple quick calls here, because we've got some folks with some questions here. Jesse is calling from Marlboro. You're on the air, Jesse.
Hi. I wanted to know what the restrictions and limits on growing and using marijuana for the residents of Massachusetts from December 15th and into the future. Thank you.
So, Jesse, I guess you meant people, what can they grow in their own homes? Because I think there is some confusion or question about that. Will Luzier?
The personal limits are, you can have up to 1 ounce in public. You can have up to
That's 10. Under existing law already.
Well, no, because law, it's decriminalized, which means you can still get a sort of a citation for it. But now there would be no citation for up to an ounce in public. You can have up to 10 ounces in your own home, so long as 9 ounces are under lock and key. You can also grow 6 plants or up to 12 plants if there are 2 people growing in the home. And those possession limits are essentially doubled, but the possession of them is decriminalized. So, for instance, if you have more than an ounce but less than 2 ounces, you can be fined $100 and have the excess taken away.
Now, Treasurer Goldberg says she thinks that the provision of allowing folks to grow up to 12 marijuana plants in their household may be too much, and she's indicated she may like to cut that.
Well, I haven't seen a good public policy reason why that needs to be cut. It's my understanding that the treasurer said, well, this is going to cut into retail sales and therefore cut into tax revenue. But I recently read an article that said the difference between home grow and walking into a retail facility, the cost is relatively the same. So if you're interested in having a garden, if you will, and you get some personal satisfaction out of that, go ahead and do it. But you're not going to save any money. It's going to be the same as walking into a retail facility.
Senator Lewis, you want to respond to that? Because and if so, briefly, because I really want to get to this question of taxes.
Again, I think we would work to respect the will of the voters here as specified in the referendum. It is the case that in Washington state, they don't allow any home growing. Colorado allows up to 6 plants, so far less than this would allow. I do think that there would it would be appropriate to consider safeguards that we would put around this to make sure that we don't get people growing at home and then having that marijuana go into the black market, because we have seen that happen in Colorado, and we know under federal law we have to prevent that from happening and from being smuggled across state lines.
And I think it's un-American to suggest that this is going to create a new criminal class of people who are going to grow this in their own homes and then sell it on the black market.
I'm not suggesting most people would do that, but if you ask law enforcement in Colorado, this is a huge challenge they have faced, is criminal elements and gangs and others who have set up shop in Colorado, hiding within the legal law to grow at home and then selling that into the black market and across state lines. When we have an obligation to prevent that in Massachusetts.
As the senator knows, under the medical marijuana program in Colorado, you're allowed to grow up to hundreds of plants. And that's the problem in Colorado. It's not the home grow for personal use that's the problem in Colorado.
It's both, actually.
Okay, so I see that this is still a major point of contention between the two of you. But I want to actually move on, if I could, to another issue which the legislature has, or members of the legislature have already talked about perhaps taking some action on, and that is how much marijuana is going to be taxed. The sale of marijuana is going to be taxed in Massachusetts, because I think this is also an equally pressing issue. First of all, let's hear some tape from Treasurer Deb Goldberg on the tax rate on marijuana in Massachusetts as was proposed and approved in question 4.
Many people I spoke to who were voting for the question would say to me, we're going to get lots and lots and lots of money. And I'd say, no, we're not.
And just to clarify, question four said that there would be a 3.75% excise tax on marijuana sales on top of the state's sales tax. And so yesterday I actually asked this question about what the legislature is going to do about it, if anything, to State Senate President Stan Rosenberg. And here's a little bit of our back and forth. It is the lowest of any state that's legalized marijuana.
Yes, by far.
Do you think the legislature is going to try to quickly push to increase that tax rate?
We have to at least cover the costs, and that those costs should not only be administration and enforcement of the law, and that will be on the table, and I think that's a fair question to ask.
Senator Lewis, a fair question, or is the legislature seriously considering raising the excise tax above 3.75%?
Well, I think what the Senate president said I would agree with, and I would hope the proponents of the question would, that the taxpayers should not be funding the implementation and regulation of this new industry in Massachusetts. And I know that the proponents believe that the tax rate is sufficient, but we're very concerned that when you add up all of not just the regulatory costs, the administrative, the legal costs, but all the public health costs, we're going to have to invest in campaigns to educate adults about responsible use, to prevent teen use. We're going to have to
train our police officers. The reasons I think are well understood, but the question is the legislature going to do something about it?
Well, I can't speak for what the legislature will do as a whole.
Would you like to see that happen?
What I can point to is the work of the Special Senate Committee on Marijuana, which I chaired and which researched marijuana for a year. And it is one of the recommendations in that report that the tax rate should be higher than it is in the ballot question, although we don't specify exactly what we think it should be.
Will Luzier, what's your thought that we do have some lawmakers saying that maybe the tax rate ought to be raised?
Well, you know, I certainly think that the program should pay for itself. But in Colorado, Andrew Friedman was in town a couple of weeks ago, and he said that they raised last year $135 million, and the marijuana program cost them $25 million. So they had $110 million left over. The ArcView report that came out in March said that this is going to generate $100 million in tax revenue, and that's more than enough to cover all the programs that the senator suggests. Plus, it doesn't take into account the income tax that's going to be generated from the 20,000 or 30,000 jobs that are created in this industry. It doesn't take into account all of the commerce that's going to be created around lawyers and real estate transactions.
Out of the creation of a new market. But in terms of Colorado's sort of a revenue pad there, but their tax rate is higher on marijuana.
Their tax rate is certainly higher. But the reason that we thought that the tax rate should be low was because it offers the opportunity to undercut the black market. And, you know, 12% may be one of the lowest. But, for instance, California, which just passed on Tuesday, their marijuana referendum, their tax is 15%. You know, so I don't have a problem with – and they have a whole range of issues that they're paying for in the initiative. Mm-hmm. So long as we have solid evidence that the costs are there – you know, I think that the tax rate is sufficient to cover the
costs. If I could say, Megan, I think the key is here, and we would agree, we've got to do our homework and figure out what all of these costs are and all the things we have to do to implement this safely and thoughtfully, and then make sure the tax revenues would cover that.
And I think that the legislature should have been doing their homework a lot before this passed.
Well, I understood, but we'll continue to look forward now. Since question four has passed, there will be a lot of policy and tools questions on how this gets implemented, and I look forward to having both of you back to continue to discuss them as those pieces fall into place. So, Will Luzier, campaign manager for Yes on 4, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us.
And Senator Jason Lewis, he's state senator and was also on the steering committee for the Campaign for a Safe and Healthy Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're looking at next steps for two of the major ballot questions voters decided on this week. Before the break, we talked about question four, which passed. And now to question two, which failed. That's the charter schools question, the referendum which would have allowed the state to approve up to 12 new charter schools per year. Now, question two was seen as a proving ground for the national charter school movement, and both sides spent an enormous sum of money on the campaign, a record more than $40 million, the most on any single ballot question in Massachusetts history. The referendum, however, was rejected by voters, 62% to 38% across the state. But, you know, that does not mean the debate over charter schools is over, nor are the deeper issues about public school funding in Massachusetts. So in a moment, we're going to hear from the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, Barbara Mataloni. But first, let's speak with one of the key groups that supported question two. He's Mark Kennan, and he's the executive director of the Massachusetts Charter Public School Association. Mark Kennan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So the Yes on Two folks spent more than $24 million in support of question two, and yet the vote went down nearly 2-1 across the state. What do you think Massachusetts voters are trying to say?
Well, we heard a message from our voters across the state that they actually have strong support for charter schools. They appreciate the work we're doing. They recognize the work we're doing, but they aren't prepared to support a major expansion of our schools at this time.
And so what does that mean then in terms of next steps for your association and for charter schools in Massachusetts?
Well, as you know, our 70 Commonwealth charter schools are some of the best public schools, not only in the state, but in the country. And so, of course, our first and most important step is to continue to do the work that we do every day with our students and families. After that, it's about trying to figure out how we can help the 32,000 families who are on our waiting list, 12,000 of whom are in Boston. So we're looking now to join forces with the legislature, the governor, and the teachers union to try to figure out other strategies if the charter school expansion is not going to be happening right now to help these families who are desperately in need of alternative public education choices.
Do you have ideas on what could specifically be done?
Well, actually, to be honest, looking towards Barbara Mataloni and the MTA and the legislature for those ideas. If you remember, during the Yes on Two campaign, the teachers union was adamant that we need to fix district schools before we have an expansion of charter schools. And so we're going to take them at that word, and we're hoping that they have a comprehensive plan that not just about new money for public education, though we strongly support that, but the reforms necessary to make our district schools, particularly in our urban communities, more effective for families who need these public education choices.
Mark Kennan, let's step back here for just a second, because this fight was so divisive. It was so expensive. It got so much national attention. I wonder, does anyone who amongst the leadership of Yes on Two wonder now if going to the ballot was the wrong thing to do?
Well, as you know, this was a desperation move on our part. It was the last-ditch effort that we had because we tried for two consecutive legislative sessions over 4 years to get a charter cap lift in the legislature, which is where we thought it belonged. And both times over the last 4 years, we were rebuffed by the teachers' union and the state Senate, who would not come up with a bill that was acceptable to the House and the governor. So we were stuck. So we certainly had trepidation about going to the ballot. We knew it was going to be a very difficult fight for us, especially against the well-funded and well-resourced teachers union. So we don't have regrets about it, but we weren't surprised by the fact that we failed at this attempt.
Just as point of fact, though, the Yes on Two side was also very well-resourced. You spent $10 million more than No on Two.
Yes.
So, I mean, I just don't understand the point of saying that the teachers union was well-resourced when both sides of the charter school debate did spend enormous amounts of money.
Well, it's not just about financial resources. It's about human resources as well. The teachers union, the No on Two campaign, ran an excellent grassroots campaign. The MTA has over 110,000 members in every city and town, and they were able to galvanize those members in those cities and towns to work on a grassroots basis. So it's not just about the total total dollar figure you bring to the campaign. These campaigns are about a lot more than dollars. It's about your base, and their base overwhelmed us in the field, and that is one of the reasons that we were not successful.
Mark Kennan, you're right to point out that this debate was in the legislature, and I would say it belongs in the legislature. And you did point out that, yes, the Senate, in terms of the RISE Act, for example, which was up this year, presented a bill that was unacceptable to the House. However, I'm curious, I mean, does it not behoove charter school activists to encourage the House, to encourage Speaker Robert DeLeo to present a bill that it likes and then send it back to the Senate and hash it out in some kind of conference committee? I mean, why is it that, like, it's a take it or leave it in terms of what comes out of the state Senate?
Well, you remember the previous legislative session, the reverse happened. The House did pass the bill first. That was a compromise bill that had the support of the governor and the charter school community, and they sent that over to the Senate, and the Senate rejected it. And then when the last legislative session happened, the reverse happened. The Senate started the bill first, and they passed a bill that the House then wouldn't take up. So we have deadlock around charter schools in the state legislature, and we're going to continue to have that deadlock, unfortunately, about charter schools in the legislature. So we are saying, and we are calling on legislators as well as the union, that we need to put aside the charter school battle for now. This does not belong in the legislature right now because it's not going to get anywhere. We're just going to have more gridlock, and it's going to distract from the other education agenda that we all have, which is to how to improve our district schools and urban communities that are failing our families.
Yeah,
that's
so,
the issue.
So this is an excellent point, and honestly, anyone who's been following my Twitter feed lately knows that it's completely my hobby horse, and that is, what is it not time for education advocates and state leaders on Beacon Hill to take a serious, good faith look at improving funding for all Massachusetts schools? I mean, is that something that charter school advocates can and will put their considerable resources and lobbying expertise? Can you throw your weight behind that?
We can definitely throw our weight behind a comprehensive proposal to improve funding for all public education. We look forward to working with our colleagues in the public education system, in the legislature, to do that. However, that cannot be used as a Trojan horse to try to get at the funding and reduce the funding for charter schools. And so that as long as the union and the state senate is using that cloak of trying to improve funding for all of public education to cut our funding, then that we will not get anywhere. So we're hoping that there's a real honest intent by both the legislative state senate and the union to work with us to come up with a proposal that would help all public education, all public schools, and not to the detriment of ours.
Well, Mark Kennan is executive director of the Massachusetts Charter Public School Association. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's hear from the Massachusetts Teachers Association. They were the biggest opponents of ballot question 2, and MTA President Barbara Mataloni joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, first of all, let me just start off with the question that I began with when I spoke to Mark Kennan, and that is, what do you think Massachusetts voters said when they voted down question 2?
Well, what I heard in all the doors I knocked and the phone calls that I had and what we heard in our powerful grassroots movement, the thing that moved me most was that people in the Commonwealth really deeply value their public schools. It was amazing to me. I would talk to people who had a child in the charter school, but they said, I don't want that to keep our public schools from flourishing. And there's a sort of amazing deep commitment and valuing of public schools. And so I think this is a message that says we value our public schools. We don't want to see those destabilized by loss of funds. And in fact, because this was part of our message as well, we want to fully fund our schools. This campaign informed people about really what we need for our public schools and that we need more resources. So I think we're ready to say, let's fully fund our public schools. Let's look at the foundation budget. This has been a distraction from the foundation budget commission recommendations. I think we're ready to do that.
Well, so we're going to get to that in a second. But and I don't necessarily want to quibble about the numbers in terms of how many students are on charter school waiting lists. I don't want to quibble about the numbers. Let's just accept the fact that there are many students who are still on a waiting list for charter schools, meaning that in certain districts, there continues to be a demand. Now, many of those families would say, we're going to have to keep waiting. I just wonder what your message is for those particular families who still see charter schools as the best option for their children and consider what happened with Question 2 as a major setback for them.
I understand that they experience it that way. And I think we have to address through conversations and through community conversations about why people feel that way. One of the things that I would really like to see come out of this is for communities to gather in conversations about not only how can we resource our public schools, but before that, what do we want for our public schools? What do we want them to look like? What's a high-quality public education look like in your community? We haven't had that conversation. As a matter of fact, it's been assumed that that's about test scores and this hyper-accountability system. But when I talk to parents about what they want for their children, they don't talk about test scores. So I think there's a democratic process that we need to engage in to bring communities together to begin to talk about this. And that's what I'd like to see happen.
You know, this debate, as I pointed out with Mark Kennan, I haven't seen a question that was as divisive as this one in quite some time. But moving forward, I personally refuse to believe that compromise isn't possible. I mean, it was compromise that began the charter school experiment to begin with, which was a good thing. So let me put something to you that Charlie Baker, that Governor Baker said just yesterday. He was asked about Question 2 failing, and he said that state leaders need to do more work to close the achievement gap. And then he pointed out that, quote, maybe this means we need to do more of the empowerment zone type approach that have been pursued in Springfield, or maybe we need to do some things to lengthen the school day. But we're going to have conversations about this to make sure we continue to work on it. So, for example, the empowerment zone idea, it's a partnership between Springfield Public Schools and the Springfield Teachers Union and the state. 8 schools involved. They're allowed to make their own decisions on hiring, scheduling, budgeting, and curriculum, but they're within the district. I mean, is that something that the MTA could maybe support?
There are other ideas out there that are really powerful. And the one that I think we should be talking about are community schools. The Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools is a national organization that really has been looking deeply at how to use our schools as community centers. So that when we're talking about extended day, we're not talking about extended like math and English for MCAS scores, but we're actually talking about the school as a center for enrichment opportunities, for the arts, for sports. Community schools as places where services are available for families that are struggling. I think that's the way that we need to go. That's really about bringing people in and together and empowering the parents. Because one of the things that we saw really clearly in this No on 2 campaign is that the parents want to talk about and have a voice in what's happening in public education. The parents on the No on 2 side in Boston were amazing. They did so much of the legwork, knocking on doors and talking to other parents, bringing people in. That's the model that I'd like to see. And not have the governor decide now that there's one model that we're going to use. There are other models out there that are much more empowering for everybody who's a part of the process.
Yeah, I think he was just suggesting as Springfield as a place to look at for some ideas. But Barbara Maddaloni, let me ask you, the MTA spent some $8 million of the roughly $14 million that No on 2 put out to defeat Question 2. Sizable amount, and as Mark Kennan pointed out, and you're talking about right now, a statewide grassroots effort, knocking on doors in almost every city and town in this state. Can that organizational ability, that lobbying muscle, that money, can and will it be put towards focusing like a laser on Beacon Hill to take care of the more fundamental funding challenges we have in K-12? You pointed at the foundation budget, right? That's the equation that the state uses to decide how much each city and town ought to be spending on public education. Hasn't been updated in 23 years. Is the MTA going to make that a priority?
The MTA has had that as a priority for years and has been one of our priority legislative pieces. We were instrumental in having the Foundation Budget Review Commission meet. So we've already had that going. What happened last year is that the charter expansion threat distracted us completely. On November 2nd, the commission that I was a part of made recommendations that said public education is being underfunded by about $1 billion
a year. Well, they said it was a moral obligation for the state to do something about it.
16 days later, the Great Schools Massachusetts held their big event in the Commons to say this is going to be about expanding charter schools. They came at us with a civil lawsuit. They said then we're going to spend $18 million. So it's been, actually, I was talking to someone today, it's been like a painful distraction because I want to work on the foundation budget. I want to work on more funding. I want to work on really imagining what a school can look like in every community, but in particular in our communities where we're serving Black and brown children who need to have curriculum that sees them reflected in it, that has staff that looks like them. Like, there's work that we should be doing that's really pedagogical work and curriculum work. And we're being distracted by the charter schools, and we're being distracted by a hyper-accountability system that really narrows the conversation about what we want children to be experiencing in the classroom.
So let me
every
ask you, will you then now focus on getting the foundation budget review commission's suggestions across the finish line? I mean, it could be in a budget, in the fiscal 18 budget, if state lawmakers deem it so.
Absolutely. And it should be. And that's our commitment. That's been our commitment from the beginning. This is not something new for us. We're also part of the Raise Up Massachusetts Coalition that's working on the Fair Share Amendment. You know, we have been committed to that. We have to do that. We also have to really work on the accountability regime, because the accountability regime with the high stakes testing focus is a key part of undermining the quality of experience that young people are having, in particular in our so-called level 3, 4, and 5 schools.
We've just got under a minute to go, and I want to ask you one last question, because again, I return to this issue of every time I think of either side of the question to fight, because it doesn't seem like anyone was, or maybe even currently still is, in a mood to compromise even a tiny bit. So as we move forward in this state, say a compromise bill comes up that does allow for the addition of a couple charter schools where the demand is highest. Would the MTA even fight that?
First of all, you need to understand demand is highest. We won this in all but 16 communities.
But answer my question.
But no, I'm going to get there.
Are you going to resist charter schools?
Let me get there. So if Wellesley that voted for this wants it, if Concord that voted for this wants it, or Lincoln, that's where the high demand is. Here's the thing.
Based on the vote, but what about where the students who are on the waiting list?
There's no reason to have a conversation about a cap lift now. Absolutely no reason. We need to fully fund our public schools. That's what we need to do.
Barbara Mataloni, she's president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
We'll be continuing this conversation.
I'm sure we will.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, I'll be honest with you. I feel like I need a little break to step away from the chaos and the din for just a moment to take a deep breath and enter a headspace that's quiet and beautiful. If you feel the same way, take a journey with me. Cast your mind's eye several miles off the coast of the New Hampshire-Maine border to a place called Star Island.
You would see just a giant expanse of sea and sky. That would be the first thing that would strike you.
This is Alexandra De Steiger. For the past 20 years, she's been Star Island's solo winter caretaker.
The island itself is rather bare. It's very scrubby, a lot of rocks, a lot of big ledges. And then on one portion of the island, there's the big old hotel. So it sort of looms up out of the rock. It has this sense of the past. Most of the buildings are very old, including the hotel. So it feels like you've been dropped not only in place, but in time. It's so quiet. That's the other thing about the island is there's no modern noise. There's no noise of any kind other than the ocean, the surf, and the lighthouse horn. sometimes the bell buoy ringing when the seas get big. But other than that, it's extremely quiet.
De Steiger winters alone on Star Island. She has an internet connection, if she wants it. She also has her camera. Her ghostly beautiful seascapes and landscapes are collected in the book Small Island, Big Picture: Winters of Solitude Teach an Artist to See. Alexandra De Steiger is also an accomplished sailor, so she says the splendid, frost-bitten solitude of a Star Island winter was a natural fit.
I was always attracted by the ocean. I wanted to go to sea, even as a young person. So when I was 18, I shipped out on my first ship. It was a tall ship out of Gloucester, Massachusetts, the Regina Maris. And I ended up being a sailor for about, I guess, 9 years on long sea voyages. And then I was visiting a shipmate who was working on Appledore Island, one of the Isles of Shoals. And he said, you know, you should come out, see the Isles of Shoals, they're gorgeous. And I lived in New Hampshire, so I'd never been. And it just so happened that they were looking for a caretaker over on Star Island. And we went over, and I was interviewed, and they hired
me. You were interviewed?
Well,
what were they looking for in a caretaker?
They were looking for someone who could live remotely and who understood, you know, things about generators and the wind. You know, being a sailor, it was kind of a perfect fit because, you know, I knew how bad storms could be. And I live off the grid in my home. So it was really a good fit.
So you're there all winter long,
yeah.
Off the grid, as you said. What do you do for food, for running water?
There's a cistern under the building that I live in, and so I collect rainwater off the roof. Sometimes I'll run out of water, and I have to pump it from the well, which is across the other side of the island. So that could be a bit of a hassle in winter because everything freezes quickly. But for food, my partner Brad visits, and he comes and brings food. So I'll email him a big list of groceries, and he'll bring it out.
So you have internet.
I do now, yes. When I first moved out 20 years ago, there was some kind of very sketchy radio phone that didn't work very often. You know, no one had cell phones back then. But now, yeah, there's internet. Living the high life out there now.
So you're the only person on the island all winter long.
Yes. Well, I'm the only person on all nine of the islands. There's nine, and they all become deserted.
And how do you... Do you revel in that solitude? I mean, how do you deal with it?
I love solitude. I just it feels like I have this whole wild enclave to myself. And I think as an artist, I get a lot out of solitude because there's a centering that happens when you're alone. You know, when you're with someone, there's always this distraction of, you know, are they enjoying themselves? But when you're alone, there's no one to interact with but yourself. So it's a way to just become quiet and to center on what's around you.
You know, the closest that I've ever had to your experience, it does not hold a candle to being a solo caretaker on a northern Atlantic island, but many years ago, I house sat for a friend for 6 or 7 days, her and her many dogs, and they live out in the country. And I just decided for whatever reason that I wasn't going to talk. I mean, I could have talked to the dogs, but, you know, they had each other, too. Uh-huh. It was so strange. After the first and second day, it was weirdly freeing. Mm. I mean, in that space that was created by the silence from human chatter, mm-hmm. which is funny to say since I make my living talking, but I felt like a kind of soulful liberation that I had never felt before.
Yeah. Yeah, living in the modern world, we take it for granted that, you know, talking is just what we do. But when you don't have to anymore... It is. It's very freeing.
On the other hand, though, I'm curious. You're on an island by yourself. Have there ever been any wild moments that were frightening?
Yeah, the storms out there can be very severe. So there was one year where there was a 91-mile-an-hour storm, and I was there alone, and I stayed inside because with the big old buildings, often the roofing tiles will fly off, and parts of the building will blow away. But even inside, it's scary because the whole house vibrates and the window glass just bows inward and you could see it. It almost looks like it's breathing. There was another storm, too, where a door on the near the hotel roof had blown in half. It just ripped in half. And so I went up with a piece of plywood. This was after the storm, but it was still quite windy. And I got up there on the roof with this plywood, and I realized that the roof itself was a sheet of ice. It was a flat portion of the hotel roof. And so being a sailor, this was really fun for me. I was able to just angle that plywood, and I sailed myself across that roof. And I set that piece of plywood up against that door, and the wind held it in place, and I was able to screw it there. And
a plywood spinnaker. Like, who would have thought? You've been doing this for 20 years, right?
Or a couple. This will be my 20th winter.
20th winter. Has the experience changed you?
Yeah, it has. I feel like I just know myself a lot better. I know what I want in life. I know what's important to my life. And that's the other thing about being alone is you get to figure yourself out.
Now, we have to talk about the fact that you're an artist as well, and you're a photographer, and I've seen some of the pictures that you've taken on the island, and they are so beautiful.
Thank you.
So, can you tell me about how looking through the lens of your camera and that way of seeing, what do you see around the island when you're doing that?
I guess the way I go about it is when I go out to photograph, I don't think about photographing. What I'll do instead is what's more natural to me, which is to just go out and sit on the rocks and wander about and thoroughly enjoy being there. And then taking pictures is almost an afterthought, you know, of just the sheer enjoyment of the experience. So then making images becomes a way to participate further with that enjoyment.
Well, I was thinking about the title of your book, right, which is Small Island, Big Picture, Winters of Solitude, Teach an Artist to See.
When I first arrived, you know, everything is new. And when you're in a new place, it's exciting to take pictures of everything because you've not seen anything before. And that's how it was for me. But then after a few years, I realized that, you know, this is a very small place and there's only so many things here to photograph. And I was a little worried that would become limiting. And then slowly I realized it was not limiting at all because there's always more to see. If you sit quietly in a spot, these subtle things that you never would have noticed start to stand out.
We think we know things. We think we're familiar with the people and the objects and the landscapes around us because we might see them frequently. But how much do we actually see them?
Yes.
And I think you need time and space and the ability to slow down in order to create an environment where you are really seeing. And then if you're able to do that, they will surprise you.
So for me, it was the more I connected with a place, you know, the more it revealed itself. It made me realize that, you know, even the things we are deeply familiar with, we can even get more from them because there's always more to see.
Yeah. And in your case, when you're spending the winters on Star Island, since you're there alone, there's the elimination of all the possible distractions that might interfere with you seeing things. I mean, that's the thing that I'm almost there and saying, take me with you. but then there wouldn't be any solitude there. So
right.
So I will impress myself upon you in that way. Before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question about you and your encounters with rough weather, because this is the 25th anniversary of the perfect storm, and you were caught in that storm.
So I had signed on the Ernestina, which is a ship out of New Bedford, and the trip was to go to the Cape Verde Islands off Africa. So we left Woods Hole and headed out for Bermuda and got, I guess, down to off of Cape Hatteras when Hurricane Grace started coming up the coast. And the seas were huge. And I'd been in storms before, but this one was, you know, I think the biggest that I'd seen. And it was scary. There was one night, especially when the seas were so massive and they were just sweeping the deck. There was a lot of damage to the ship. And we ended up not going to Africa because there's just too much damage. And so we went and we sailed around the Caribbean instead.
Can you tell me what it feels like in the first moments after the weather calms down when you realize you've survived?
As a sailor, you understand that going to sea is a risky thing. So I think the fact that you signed up for that means that you're the kind of person that that type of fear is not going to affect so largely. That's the risk you take. You might die. And so it's not as big a deal as you would think.
Wow. But I get it. It's all about that mindset.
It's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and when people say, are you scared on the island, you know, when these big storms come? And I said, well, you know, I have a little perspective on that because I'm not, no, I'm not scared. I'm on solid rock, you know, and I'm not on a rocking ship that could sink, you know. So everything is perspective.
Even with those Boeing glass windows. But so I guess on that note, let me just ask you, you're going out for your 20th winter on Star Island. What's the first thing you're going to do? What's the first thing you usually do?
The first thing I will do, I think, is head out to the rocks on the east side where the ledges are high, and I'll probably stand there and I'll just soak it all in and prepare myself for another long winter alone.
Alexandra De Steiger is a photographer and winter caretaker of Star Island. Alexandra, thank you so much, so very much for speaking with us, and I hope you have a great winter
out
there.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.